Howdy, regulars. This is Regular Dispatch 33. It's June 15th, 2020. First, there was civil rights, and then there was the war, and now it is the environment. The first two of this sequence of causes have already risen to the top of the nation's consciousness and declined somewhat in a remarkably short time. I mention this in order to begin with what I believe to be a justifiable skepticism. For it seems to me that the civil rights movement and the peace movement, as popular causes in the electronic age, have partaken far too much of the nature of fads. Not for all, certainly, but for too many, they have been the fashionable politics of the moment. As causes, they have been undertaken too much in ignorance. They have been too much simplified. They have been powered too much by impatience and guilt of conscience and short-term enthusiasm, and too little by an authentic social vision and long-term conviction and deliberation. For most people, those causes have remained almost entirely abstract. There has been too little personal involvement and too much involvement in organizations that were insisting that other organizations should do what is right. There is considerable danger that the environment movement will have the same nature, that it will be a public cause served by organizations that will self-righteously criticize and condemn other organizations, inflated for a while by a lot of public talk in the media, only to be replaced in its turn by another fashionable crisis. I hope that will not happen, and I believe that there are ways to keep it from happening. But I know that if this effort is carried on solely as a public cause, if millions of people cannot or will not undertake it as a private cause as well, then it is sure to happen. In 5 years, the energy of our present concern will have petered out in a series of public gestures and no doubt in a series of empty laws, and a great, and perhaps the last, human opportunity will have been lost. It need not be that way. A better possibility is that the movement to preserve the environment will be seen to be, as I think it has to be, not a digression from the civil rights and peace movements, but the logical culmination of those movements. For I believe that the separation of these three problems is artificial. They have the same cause, and that is the mentality of greed and exploitation. The mentality that exploits and destroys the natural environment is the same that abuses racial and economic minorities, that imposes on young men the tyranny of the military draft, that makes war against peasants and women and children with the indifference of technology. The mentality that destroys a watershed and then panics at the threat of flood is the same mentality that gives institutionalized insult to black people and then panics at the prospect of race riots. It is the same mentality that can mount deliberate warfare against a civilian population and then express moral shock at the logical consequence of such warfare at My Lai. We would be fools to believe that we could solve any one of these problems without solving the others. To me, one of the most important aspects of the environmental movement is that it brings us not just to another public crisis, but to a crisis of the protest movement itself. For the environmental crisis should make it dramatically clear, as perhaps it has not always been before, that there is no public crisis that is not also private. To most advocates of civil rights, racism has seemed mostly the fault of someone else. For most advocates of peace, the war has been a remote reality, and the burden of the blame has seemed to rest mostly on the government. I am certain that these crises have been more private, and that we each have suffered more from them and been more responsible for them than has been readily apparent. But the connections have been difficult to see. Racism and militarism have been institutionalized among us for too long for our personal involvement in those evils to be easily apparent to us. Think, for example, of all the Northerners who assumed, until black people attempted to move into their neighborhoods, that racism was a Southern phenomenon. But the environmental crisis rises closer to home. Every time we draw breath, every time we drink a glass of water, every time we eat a bite of food, we are suffering from it. And more important, every time we indulge in or depend on the wastefulness of our economy, and our economy's first principle is waste, we are causing the crisis. Nearly every one of us, nearly every day of his life, is contributing directly to the ruin of this planet. A protest meeting on the issue of environmental abuse is not a convocation of accusers. It is a convocation of the guilty. That realization ought to clear the smog of self-righteousness that has almost conventionally hovered over these occasions, and let us see the work that is to be done. In this crisis, it is certain that every one of us has a public responsibility. We must not cease to bother the government and the other institutions to see that they never become comfortable with easy promises. For myself, I want to say that I hope I never again go to Frankfurt to present a petition to the governor on an issue so vital as that of strip mining, only to be dealt with by some ignorant functionary, as several of us were not so long ago, the governor himself being too busy to receive us. Next time, I will go prepared to wait as long as necessary to see that the petitioners' complaints and their arguments are heard fully and by the governor. And then I will hope to find ways to keep those complaints and arguments from being forgotten until something is done to relieve them. The time has passed when it was merely enough to elect our officials. We will have to elect them and then go and watch them and keep our hands on them, the way the coal companies do. We've made a tradition in Kentucky of putting self-servers and worse in charge of our vital interests. I'm sick of it. And I think one way to change it is to make Frankfurt a less comfortable place. I believe in American political principles, and I will not sit idly by and see those principles destroyed by sorry practice. I am ashamed and deeply distressed that the American government should have become the chief cause of disillusionment with American principles. And so, when the government in Frankfurt again proves too stupid or too blind or too corrupt to see the plain truth and to act with simple decency, I intend to be there, and I trust that I won't be alone. I hope, moreover, to be there not with a sign or a slogan or a button, but with the facts and the arguments. A crowd whose discontent has risen no higher than the level of a slogan is only a crowd. But a crowd that understands the reasons for its discontent and knows the remedies is a vital community, and it will have to be reckoned with. I would rather go before the government with two men who have a competent understanding of an issue and who therefore deserve a hearing than with 2,000 who are vaguely dissatisfied. But even the most articulate public protest is not enough. We don't live in the government or in institutions or in our public utterances and acts. And the environmental crisis has its roots in our lives. By the same token, environmental health will also be rooted in our lives. That is, I take it, simply a fact. And in light of it, we can see how superficial and foolish we would be to think that we could correct what is wrong merely by tinkering with the institutional machinery. The changes that are required are fundamental changes in the way we are living. What we are up against in this country, in any attempt to invoke private responsibility, is that we have nearly destroyed private life. Our people have given up their independence in return for the cheap seductions and the shoddy merchandise of so-called affluence. We have delegated all our vital functions and responsibilities to salesmen and agents and bureaus and experts of all sorts. We cannot feed or clothe ourselves or entertain ourselves or communicate with each other or to be charitable or neighborly or loving or even respect ourselves without recourse to a merchant or a corporation or a public service organization or an agency of the government or a style setter or an expert. Most of us cannot think of dissenting from the opinions or the actions of one organization without first forming a new organization. Individualism is going around these days in uniform, handing out the party line on individualism. Dissenters want to publish their personal opinions over 1,000 signatures. The Confucian Great Digest says that the chief way for the production of wealth, and he is talking about real goods, not money, is that the producers be many and the mere consumers be few. But even in the much publicized rebellion of the young against the materialism of the affluent society, the consumer mentality is too often still intact. The standards of behavior are still those of kind and quantity. The security sought is still the security of numbers, and the chief motive is still the consumer's anxiety that he's missing out on what is in. In this state of total consumerism, which is to say a state of helpless dependence on things and services and ideas and motives that we have forgotten how to provide ourselves, all meaningful contact between ourselves and the earth is broken. We do not understand the earth in terms either of what it offers us or of what it requires of us. And I think it is the rule that people inevitably destroy what they do not understand. Most of us are not directly responsible for strip mining and extractive agriculture and other forms of environmental abuse. But we are guilty nevertheless, for we connive in them by our ignorance. We are ignorantly dependent on them. We do not know enough about them. We do not have a particular enough sense of their danger. Most of us, for example, not only do not know how to produce the best food in the best way, we don't know how to produce any kind in any way. Our model citizen is a sophisticate who before puberty understands how to produce a baby, but who at the age of 30 will not know how to produce a potato. And for this condition, we have elaborate rationalizations instructing us that dependence for everything on somebody else is efficient and economic and a scientific miracle. I say, instead, that it is madness, mass-produced. A man who understands the weather only in terms of golf is participating in a chronic public insanity that either he or his descendants will be bound to realize as suffering. I believe that the death of the world is breeding in such minds much more certainly and much faster than in any political capital or atomic arsenal. For an index of our loss of contact with the earth, we need only look at the condition of the American farmer, who must in our society, as in every society, enact man's dependence on the land and his responsibility to it. In an age of unparalleled affluence and leisure, the American farmer is harder pressed and harder worked than ever before. His margin of profit is small. His hours are long. His outlays for land and equipment and the expenses of maintenance and operation are growing rapidly greater. He cannot compete with industry for labor. He is being forced to more and more to depend on the use of destructive chemicals and on the wasteful methods of haste and anxiety. As a class, farmers are one of the despised minorities. So far as I can see, farming is considered marginal or incidental to the economy of the country. And farmers, when they are thought of at all, are thought of as hicks and yokels, whose lives do not fit into the modern scene. The average American farmer is now an old man whose sons have moved away to the cities. His knowledge and his intimate connection with the land are about to be lost. The small independent farmer is going the way of the small independent craftsmen and storekeepers. He's being forced off the land into the cities, his place taken by absentee owners, corporations, and machines. Some would justify all this in the name of efficiency. As I see it, it is an enormous social and economic and cultural blunder. For the small farmers who lived on their farms cared about their land, and given their established connection to their land, which was often hereditary and traditional, as well as economic, they could have been encouraged to care for it more completely than they have so far. The corporations and machines that replace them will never be bound to the land by the sense of birthright and continuity or by the love that enforces care. They will be bound by the rule of efficiency, which takes thought only of the volume of the year's produce and takes no thought of the slow increment of the life of the land, not measurable in pounds or dollars, which will assure the livelihood and the health of the coming generations. If we are to hope to correct our abuses of each other and of other races and of our land, and if our effort to correct these abuses is to be more than a political fad that will in the long run be only another form of abuse, then we are going to have to go far beyond public protest, and political action. We are going to have to rebuild the substance and the integrity of private life in this country. We are going to have to gather up the fragments of knowledge and responsibility that we have parceled out to the bureaus and the corporations and the specialists. And we are going to have to put those fragments back together again in our own minds and in our families and households and neighborhoods. We need better government, no doubt about it, but we also need better minds, better friendships, better marriages, better communities. We need persons and households that do not have to wait upon organizations, but can make necessary changes in themselves on their own. For most of the history of this country, our motto, implied or spoken, has been, think big. I have come to believe that a better motto, an essential one now, is think little. That implies the necessary change of thinking and feeling and suggests the necessary work. Thinking big has led us to the two biggest and cheapest political dodges of our time, plan making and lawmaking. The lotus eaters of this era are in Washington, D.C., thinking big. Somebody comes up with a problem and somebody in the government comes up with a plan or a law. The result mostly has been the persistence of the problem and the enlargement and enrichment of the government. But the discipline of thought is not generalization. It is detail, and it is personal behavior. While the government is studying and funding and organizing its big thought, nothing is being done. But the citizen who is willing to think little and accepting the discipline of that to go ahead on his own is already solving the problem. A man who is trying to live as a neighbor to his neighbors will have a lively and practical understanding of the work of peace and brotherhood, and let there be no mistake about it. He is doing that work. A couple who make a good marriage and raise healthy, morally competent children are serving the world's future more directly and surely than any political leader, though they never utter a public word. A good farmer who is dealing with the problem of soil erosion on an acre of ground has a sounder grasp of the problem and cares more deeply about it and is probably doing more to solve it than any bureaucrat who is talking about it in general. A man who is willing to undertake the discipline and the difficulty of mending his own ways is worth more to the conservation movement than 100 who insisting merely that the government and the industries mend their ways. If you're concerned about the proliferation of trash, then by all means, start an organization in your community to do something about it. But before and while you organize, pick up some cans and bottles yourself. That way, at least, you will assure yourself and others that you mean what you say. If you're concerned about air pollution, help push for government controls, but drive your car less. Use less fuel in your home. If you're worried about the damming of wilderness rivers, join the Sierra Club, write to the government, but turn off the lights you're not using. Don't install an air conditioner. Don't be a sucker for electrical gadgets. Don't waste water. In other words, if you are fearful of the destruction of the environment, then learn to quit being an environmental parasite. We all are, in one way or another, and the remedies are not always obvious, though they certainly will always be difficult. They require a new kind of life, harder, more laborious, poorer in luxuries and gadgets, but also, I am certain, richer in meaning and more abundant in real pleasure. To have a healthy environment, we'll all have to give up things we like. We may even have to give up things we have come to think of as necessities. But to be fearful of the disease and yet unwilling to pay for the cure is not just hypocritical. It is to be doomed. If you talk a good line without being changed by what you say, then you are not just hypocritical and doomed. You've become an agent of the disease. Consider, for example, President Nixon, who advertises his grave concern about the destruction of the environment, who turns out the air conditioner to make it cool enough to build a fire. Odds, as I am sure it will appear to some, I can think of no better form of personal involvement in the cure of the environment than that of gardening. A person who is growing a garden, if he is growing it organically, is improving a piece of the world. He is producing something to eat, which makes him somewhat independent of the grocery business, but he is also enlarging for himself the meaning of food and the pleasure of eating. The food he grows will be fresher, more nutritious, less contaminated by poisons and preservatives and dyes than what he can buy at a store. He is reducing the trash problem. A garden is not a disposable container, and it will digest and reuse its own wastes. If he enjoys working in his garden, then he is less dependent on an automobile or a merchant for his pleasure. He is involving himself directly in the work of feeding people. If you think I'm wandering off the subject, let me remind you that most of the vegetables necessary for a family of four can be grown on a plot of 40 by 60 feet. I think we might see in this an economic potential of considerable importance, since we now appear to be facing the possibility of widespread famine. How much food could be grown in the dooryards of cities and suburbs? How much could be grown along the extravagant rights-of-ways of the interstate system? Or how much could be grown by the intensive practices and economics of the small farm on so-called marginal lands? Louis Broomfield liked to point out that the people of France survived crisis after crisis because they were a nation of gardeners who, in times of want, turned with great skill to their own small plots of ground. And F.H. King, an agriculture professor who traveled extensively in the Orient in 1907, talked to a Chinese farmer who supported a family of 12, one donkey, one cow, and two pigs on 2.5 acres of cultivated land, and who did this, moreover, by agricultural methods that were sound enough organically to have maintained his land in prime fertility through several thousand years of such use. These are possibilities that are readily apparent and attractive to minds that are prepared to think little. To big thinkers, the bureaucrats and businessmen of agriculture, they are quite simply invisible. But intensive, organic agriculture kept the farms of the Orient thriving for thousands of years, whereas extensive, which is to say exploitive or extractive agriculture, has critically reduced the fertility of American farmlands in a few centuries or even a few decades. A person who undertakes to grow a garden at home by practices that will preserve rather than exploit the economy of the soil has set his mind decisively against what is wrong with us. He is helping himself in a way that dignifies him and that is rich in meaning and pleasure. But he is doing something else that is more important. He is making vital contact with the soil and the weather on which his life depends. He will no longer look upon rain as an impediment of traffic or upon the sun as a holiday decoration, and his sense of man's dependence on the world will have grown precise enough, one would hope, to be politically clarifying and useful. What I am saying is that if we apply our minds directly and competently to the needs of the earth, then we will have begun to make fundamental and necessary changes in our minds. We will begin to understand and to mistrust and to change our wasteful economy, which markets not just the produce of the earth, but also the earth's ability to produce. We will see that beauty and utility are alike dependent upon the health of the world, but we will also see through the fads and the fashions of protest. We will see that war and oppression and pollution are not separate issues, but are aspects of the same issue. Amid the outcries for the liberation of this group or that, we will know that no person is free except in the freedom of other persons, and that man's only real freedom is to know and faithfully occupy his place, a much humbler place than we have been taught to think, in the order of creation. But the change of mind I am talking about involves not just a change of knowledge, but also a change of attitude toward our essential ignorance, a change in our bearing in the face of mystery. The principle of ecology, if we will take it to heart, should keep us aware that our lives depend upon other lives and upon processes and energies in an interlocking system that, though we can destroy it, we can neither fully understand nor fully control. And our great dangerousness is that, locked in our selfish and myopic economics, we will have been willing to change or destroy far beyond our power to understand. We are not humble enough or reverent enough. Some time ago, I heard a representative of a paper company refer to conservation as a, quote, no return investment. This man's thinking was exclusively oriented to the annual profit of his industry. Circumscribed by the demand that profit be great, he simply could not be answerable to any other demand, not even to the obvious needs of his own children. Consider in contrast the profound ecological intelligence of Black Elk, a holy man of the Oglala Sioux, who, in telling his story, said that it was not his own life that was important to him, but what he had shared with all life. Quote, "It is the story of all life that is holy, and it is good to tell, and all of us two-leggeds sharing in it with the four-leggeds and the wings of the air and all green things." And of the great vision that came to him when he was a child, he said, "I saw that the sacred hoop of my people was one of many hoops that made one circle, wide as daylight and starlight, and in the center grew one mighty flowering tree to shelter all the children of one mother and father. And I saw that it was holy." All right, that was a long one. That's Think Little by Wendell Berry. And it was published in A Continuous Harmony, Essays Cultural and Agricultural, reprinted in the Whole Earth Catalog, 1969. So now here we are again with protests and crises and trouble. And I don't know about you, but a lot of that sounds very apt today. One thing that's fascinating is I do believe a great many are working on these, the issues of the day personally, not merely publicly, though it's interesting to hear him reflect on people performing in public in 1969 and now in the era of social media, the performative side of things is gone completely haywire. Wendell Berry is a fascinating figure. He's still alive. He's a farmer, a poet, essayist, novelist. There's a famous confrontation he had with, I guess, the head of the Department of Agriculture on some college campus, maybe in the early 70s. Pretty sure I can find that on YouTube. I'll put it in the show notes at regular.fm/33. And links to his books. And friends here in Austin did a documentary on him. It's called Look and See. It's wonderful. And fascinatingly, and in total congruence with this essay, he would not appear on camera. He was interviewed extensively, so the audio of him in his own voice is used throughout the film, but he literally doesn't own any screens. I don't believe he has electrical power in his house, and he's a farmer. So I think all the writing he's ever done is longhand and typewritten, handed to other people. He has a great essay about why he will never own a computer. I'll link to that in the show notes as well. It's principally because he is so angered by the strip mining in Kentucky that he will not himself use the electricity that comes from knocking down a mountain and ruining the land, in his view. So Look and See is a fantastic film. The Unsettling of American Agriculture is a book of his that I believe rose from the speech, and he has just a number of incredible poems and you know, fictional stories as well. Great writer and thinker. He's got this great piece too, that we all come from divorce, that things that should be together have been taken apart, and it's our job to pick up two things, not all things, it's too much work to pick up all things, but pick up two things and get them back together. It's a powerful, powerful device or lens for any of us to use when thinking about what we're doing day to day. This essay's been on my mind continuously ever since I first read it a few years, several years ago. It's especially on my mind these days. And it's striking, you know, Austin Kleon in one of these dispatches last week, I read a part from Steal Like an Artist, where he's talking about how all creation like that of cultural sort of art and such involves the remixing of what's come before. And he quoted Ecclesiastes chapter 1, that there's nothing new under the sun, and, you know, use that while making a point about, again, about art and the development of culture. It's interesting and somewhat humbling and a little bit sad that it also applies to historical trends, because in that same passage, it's talking about how there's nothing new under the sun. You don't know. You have forgotten all that came before. What you're going through now, others have been through before. In the future, people will go through it all again, and they won't remember what you're going through now, basically. And so that's not the most hopeful thing. Nonetheless, within this Think Little, I think, is a whole lot of hope. He is, of course, still laying on the table. He was an activist, still to this day in his 80s, he's an activist. He goes to the government, makes petitions, and asks for things, and wants the government to be better, wants institutions to be better. But for all of us, I think it's worth diving in and listening to Wendell Berry and actually looking at him, not just what he said, but what he's done, because he stands as quite an example in our lifetime of really walking the walk, not merely talking the talk. And I enjoy putting his ideas into the same, you know, threading them into this same rope here with Julian Simon and Eleanor Ostrom and a whole host of others that we'll keep working on. Thanks, y'all.